Thank you very much, Bob. I'm Jimmy Colvin, a very grateful recovering alcoholic. It's like Mary had mentioned earlier, it certainly is a pleasure for me to be here. The program is amazing, isn't it? With the grace of God and the fellowship, I'll have 5 years in a couple of months. And I never expected as a kid growing up that AA would be one of the program of living. You know, I was one of those kids born and brought up in south of Boston on the Cape Cod, and one of eight kids. In fact, sometimes when I introduce myself, I refer to myself as a recovering CIA, you know, Catholic Irish alcoholic. And I'm also very fortunate to have found Al-Anon almost 4 years ago, and I love every Al-Anon here as well as all of the AAs as well as I do all of in my own area, because I found so much, a different perspective from the disease, and it's done so much for me. But being one of eight kids, Catholic kids, back in the South Shore of Massachusetts, you know, when you're Catholic, you become altar boys. We call them junior priests. And I was the third in line. I was the fifth child of the eight kiddos. And thinking that it was a normal upbringing, this is what the word that I don't believe has a definition, at least from where I'm coming from, is normal. Because I insisted for so many years that I came from a normal upbringing, and I defied anyone to tell me I didn't, because, goddammit, I was going to be from a normal family. Today, I realize my folks did the best they could, but there was a lot of dysfunctionalism there, and naturally, it comes out in the kids as they get older. But there was a lot of crazy weekends. I had a bachelor uncle on my mother's side, Uncle Jimmy, who would come down 5 or 6 times a year for these 3-day weekends, and he'd bring down about 4 bottles of alcohol, several quarts of ice cream, and some candy for the kids. And the booze was gone before the ice cream and candy was gone. There was all-night sessions, and as my dad and my uncle and the 3 neighbors and my another friend would come over, you know, the loud talk and the boisterous actions and what was going on, you know, I didn't want any part of it. I'd look around the corner, and I'd see the crazy behavior and the screaming. No one's listening, and they're all talking. And no one ever went to bed. It was one of those deals where you just drink through the night. So my younger brother and I was about 6 years old at the time. We'd retreat back to our room, and I became a very shy, introverted type of a person. And booze was the furthest thing in my mind. And as I get older, you know, the kids were athletic, and we were very fortunate to live in a very sports community. In fact, as we proceeded to play ball, years ago, Look Magazine was a national publication, and our school was on the cover during my era, and we had won 50 games in a row nationally. So we had that kind of acclaim, and the popularity in that area was, you know, all us. And so booze, again, was not even considered by me. My brothers didn't drink it either. And my father insisted that I, in turn, take the college courses. Being the third kid, my two oldest brothers didn't care much for studying. So I was going to be made the example, you know, take my Latin, my French, my trigonometry, chemistry, all of that jazz, you know, to go on to bigger and better things. Well, unfortunately, I never was a 6'2", 200-pound quarterback, as this other fellow was. I was a little bit smaller than I am now, a lot narrower. So consequently, when high school ended, you know, there was nowhere to go. I said, like, shit, I mean, there's no more fun and games. There was later a lot of fun games, but not as I foresaw it at that time. So, but I was really kind of ticked off because I was told what to do. My father said, you're going to take these subjects. In turn, I started seeing a little girl my sophomore year, and I was told I couldn't see her anymore, and if I did, my homeroom teacher wouldn't help with my Latin during my study period. All of these gosh darn things are saying people were making decisions for me. And I became you know, defiant to the degree where I would always talk back. And my dad, not realizing at the time he would be drinking on his weekends, even if we didn't have company, he'd bring home a bottle or two on weekends, and he was in, you know, Never Never Land come Saturday night when it was time for Jimmy to go to the local high school dance. And I'd ask him if I can go, and he'd always beat around the bush, and the bus left at 7 and 5 off 7. Oh, can I go? Then he'd say, well, ask your sister. My sister was 8 years old at the time. Which meant to me that was, you know, asinine. I would yell and rant and rave, and I'd go, and he said, be home by 10, and naturally the bus doesn't come back till 12 o'clock, so I was grounded. I was grounded continually. You can't go out, you know, so you sneak out. You become defiant, and you just say, God damn it, I can't wait until I start making my own decisions. Well, One time, I think it was, I was a junior in high school, and we had met girls down on the beach, and they were going to babysit that night, and I had been grounded. So I asked if I can go out, and they said no. Well, about 8 o'clock, I went to bed in the summertime, which is most unusual, Labor Day weekend. And naturally, I went in the bedroom, opened the window, and went on the roof and shinnied down the post, and I was on my way. And my uncle was down this weekend, and the booze and the drinking was crazy. Now, my dad and my uncle never agreed on a thing. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. One was the Red Sox fan, the other was a Yankee fan. One was for Social Security, one was against it. You name it, and they were against it. Well, I get back around midnight, left me off at the corner, and I snuck up, and I heard this screaming. When that little son of a bitch gets in, I'm going to kick his ass. My uncle would say, "That's right, Bill, break his ass." I said, "Shit, they're going to kill me." So I climbed up the ladder and climbed up the post, get in the window, went to bed. And 2 minutes later, my mother came upstairs, and I, you know, pulled her in. And I said, "You know, what's happening?" So she asked me what happened. I told her I went out, and would she help me with my dad? Well, she did. But it was always this type of harangue was going on. And to this day, I don't know what I did. But I know I must have screwed up a lot, because thinking back from where I'm at today, I couldn't understand what the hell I did. Like, there were 7 of us at the time. At Christmas time, we all had stockings on the fireplace. Things were put in all the stockings, and I had 4 pieces of coal in mine. And 4 pieces of coal. Now, I know there was no coal mine out back, you know, that I was going to inherit it all, but I don't know what the hell I did. To this day, no one knows what I did, but I got coal in my stocking. So, anyway, as time went on, I said, "Bullshit, I can't wait to get on my own." And I joined the Army. Well, I was a very poor soldier. My job was keeping the barracks warm and keeping water hot for the showers and for shaving. And it so happened I was up in New York State at one of the camps there, and they had a wooden coal bin. Now, this is in wooden barracks. And I just took the coal, the ashes out of 1st Platoon and put them in this coal bin. Well, there were red hot ashes. By the time I was down the 4th Platoon, the goddamn fire trucks were up putting out the fire at the 1st Platoon. The whole thing had caught on fire. And naturally, I was grounded. They pulled my Class A pass. And it really ticked me because, you know, it was an accident. So I just pulled someone else's Class A and went in town. From that point on, it seemed to me that I started defying the rules of society and did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, goddammit, and it's going to be my way or no way. And to prove it a little later on, I got out of the service and was recalled to go to Korea back many moons ago. And I almost, you know what, when I got the goddamn certified letter, "You'll be report for a physical on Saturday," as in, my MO was infantrymen. Up in Korea, they don't keep barracks warm and hot water for shaving. So the night before I went in, I said, "I've got to get the hell out of this." And it so happened that there was a truss in my brother's drawer. He hurt his back playing ball. And I told a buddy that I was checking in for the physical, what I was going to try to do. Put the truss on and create an accident, an illusion, and see where it took me. Well, he said he wouldn't squeal on me, so I said, okay. So went in there at 8:30, and I couldn't move. And, of course, they asked the question, and I had an accident 6 months ago, the lower back, because I heard the lower back couldn't be detected in an x-ray. They took 15 lower back x-rays and proceeded with this doctor, So come 4:30 in the afternoon, when anyone that had a problem would see the CO and see whether they were accepted or rejected. So when it came my turn to see him, he said, "I've got bad news for you, soldier." And I figure they found out that I was playing games. They said, "We can't take you with us. You're in no physical condition." And I said, "Son of a gun," you know, with it crying on the outside and laughing like a son of a bitch on the inside. And that's when I became, you know, my God. I said, "Jimmy, there's only one person that can take care of you, and that's you. You know, you've got that magic touch, so to speak, and don't let anyone dump on you. Look out for yourself." You know, the keen mind and all of that garbage. So what I did, again, going back to the Catholic aspect of me, I had married my wife at the time when I was 21, and we felt as though we wanted to work and save money to buy a lot to have a house built and so forth. So, and no birth control or could be had. So we abstained from sex for 2.5 years. Now, see how much of an alcoholic I was then? Extreme whacked out spill. But that's the way it was. And today I really believe that that was not the underlying reason, but it was because I wasn't ready for a commitment and I didn't know anything about, you know, being that kind of a responsible person. So this is just, you know, one whacked-out alcoholic's mind rationalizing as to what took place then. So anyway, we got the house and all of that jazz. So she became pregnant about 30 days after, I think we started to, what were we doing? Yeah, that's what it was. And she became sick and frigid, and that was it. That was the end of that ball game. So, and no booze now. I still haven't drank it. I'm 23 or 23 and a half. And my brother, my dear brother Joe, who was the one up for me, who I idolize and I still think he's an incredible guy, was the man of the world, was a salesman on the road, and where he had lots of friends at lots of dropping off places. He said, come on down to the club car. I want to introduce you to a couple of my friends. I went down there and I met his friends, and I had some VO and ginger, and it tasted good. And I had some more, and it tasted even better. And I said, God dang. I said, I'm one of those adults now. You know, there's no reason why I can't behave like my father, my uncle, my friends, neighbors behave, because isn't that what adults do? And I never thought that I was being irresponsible as far as taking care of the house is concerned, because I was working as a salesman, providing. But we both realized today there was a lot of, you know, bullshit as far as I was concerned. But as a kid, and there was another one came along in about 3 years, as the kids grew up, I became very involved athletically, Little League, and having three sons, that was my bag. But by the same token, I always would make sure I went to my local haunts, and I never went to a bar. It was always a lounge, you know, piano bar, the mystique of the little lights, the little stars on the ceiling, and atmosphere. That was it. So I can recall going to this place up in a nearby town, the Eagles Club. And a friend of mine, several friends of mine are up there. You know, we always seek our same type so that we can be supportive of each other. But we always think that maybe I'm a little better off than him. He drinks more than I do, and he can't function as well as I can because, you know, he drinks too much. Never looking at self. It's so much easier to look at the other people than looking at JTC. And Vincent was the type of a person who had a very responsible job inspecting boilers for power plants. He had done it for 25 years, and he in turn was in semi-retirement. But his company didn't realize that. They thought he was making the calls all over New England, and he never left the Eagles Hall. He would have that down to a science, write a 30-page manuscript on detailing a power plant in Rhode Island that he hadn't seen in 9 months. His car is turned in by the company every 24 months, or 24,000 miles. His expense account said he'd gone 24,000 miles. His odometer read 6,000. So he had to go to the garage and have his odometer move forward from 6,000 to 24,000. God, I'd love to have got one of his trade-ins. But those were the type of people that, you know, I associated with because they were fun, they were different, they loved playing cards. I was always a good card player. And whether it be poker, cribbage, hearts, you name it, and if I don't know it, I'll learn it, and we bet money, naturally. Everything's the challenge. And another time I was with another friend, had won $8,000 one night playing poker, two-handed poker. And this is all happening now as I'm riding this crest. I can do not a gall-down thing wrong. You know, JTC is Christ Jr., and the world is my oyster. So this one hand playing poker, I can remember it vividly. And, you know, he was half-bombed and I was half-bombed, but we do remember certain happenings in our lives. And this one hand, there was probably $1,500 there, and he dealt me a flush, but one card was turned up. So he pulled it because it was a dead hand. And naturally, I'm ticked off because I thought I had a winner. He dealt me four queens the next hand. And any true alcoholic who loves gambling, who in turn sees $1,500 in the pot and sees four queens in his hand, he is in euphoric heaven because he knows he just won this hand. And that was part of this transition that I was going through at that time. And as I say, I won $8,000 that night. And that was a crazy aspect of this crest. I was the type of a person who wanted to reach out and get as high, as far as enjoyment, as far as excitement. Case in point, in that era, there was about 21 gangland murders in the Boston area. And this one person was shot four or five times, whose wife was one of these little lounge visitors. And I thought it would be goddamn exciting to go around with the wife of a gangster, and it would create that syndrome of, well, today it's sick excitement. But then it was, how high is high? And it didn't bother me at all that she was being watched by a bodyguard and that this other stuff was going on. She was pretty, she was funny, and she was crazy. I wasn't pretty, but I was funny and crazy and wild, and we did crazy wild things. And at that time, it was just, I didn't give a shit what happened on any given day because it was going to be, live it as high as you can. And it isn't as though I was drinking to get bombed out of my skull, but the mystique of life was there for me that I just wanted to sap it up and enjoy it. Now, the other crazy aspect of it is, I didn't drink before noontime, you know how the denial, didn't drink at home, didn't drink weekends, but shit, Monday through Friday, shoot the moon. And all of a sudden, I noticed as I was driving, these red and blue flashing lights started appearing behind me as I was weaving down the road. And I got my first DWI. I don't know what they call them in Utah, but just driving while intoxicated, driving under the influence, or whatever. I started to get those back there, and it was no big deal because I didn't like the cops. They were out to ruin my time. And I had a friend by the name of Bobby McAvoy, and another fine Irishman, that would testify at my trials as a character witness, and I would be a character witness at his trials. So we in turn got attorneys, and we were the good guys, we whipped the cops, whipped the prosecutor, and I had seven DWIs back there. Well, it got to be not only expensive, it got to be, well, everyone knew about it. The local radio station, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, they get the police blotter from where I was and arrested for a DWI as James Colvany. I'm saying, shit, do you have to give that out, you know? Do you have to go public? So shit was hitting the fan. And it was time to move west. Isn't that Horace Greeley that said, go west, young man, go west? So I went from Massachusetts out to Phoenix in 1970 with three sons under the guise of being able to play baseball year-round. Don't like the cold weather, don't like the snow. But many of us alcoholics realize that we're making a geographic under the guise of something that's really not so. I've been very fortunate with the kids because they did very well athletically, and they all had scholarships to U of A and other baseball schools. And my oldest boys were the Houston Astros as a coach, and my youngest boys were the White Sox as a minor league player. So that helped them, but it was also, you know, I was bullshitting the world because I would be coming to their ball games and being that goddamn parent that was screaming at the umpire, half, you know, out of my skull with booze and making a complete ass out of myself, but I refused to accept it and see what was happening. I had been in Arizona 2 weeks when I got my first DWI there. And of course, a friend of mine told my brother before leaving Massachusetts, he says, doesn't Jimmy realize they serve alcohol in Arizona? They got bars out there. And today I realize if I could have brought someone else out in place of me, I might have made the transition without any problems. But I brought myself along and I was here 2 weeks and I got zapped for a DWI. As time went on, you know, the game again, when you play the game, accept the pain. And it was all hush-hush because I didn't want to tell anyone what the hell was happening to me. Now, this is the other part about my personality, the illusion. You know, the person with a smile on his face who is trying to be pleasant and friendly with his friends in the afternoon at the bars or in the evening and handle business okay, yet he's dying because he knows, goddammit, he's losing it. It never used to be that way. Why can't it be the way it used to be? Why can't it be fun? How come, my goddammit, I hit a DWI and I got to go to jail, I go to court? All of this bit was happening, and I didn't know what to do about it because it had never happened before, and I wanted to have it returned to yesterday. So naturally, we become systematic. Well, I'm only going to have two drinks. I won't go there Monday. I'll go there Wednesday and Friday. So we make adjustments as far as our stop-offs. We don't stay as long. And, of course, I always blamed my problems on the last drink or the next to last drink or the last five drinks, never on the first drink. And today, naturally, I realize it's entirely different. As time was going on, more problems arose as far as I was making a pain in the ass out of myself at my youngest boy's ball games. I, in turn, was loaded there one night, and he was playing Legion ball. They had won 9 in a row, undefeated, and I took it too serious. They had a coach that loved all the kids, and he played all the kids. And having been involved in sports, I says, you play your best, you go the furthest, and so forth and so on. So I was swearing and yelling four-letter words at him, and his wife and kids were there and so forth. And my little guy in left field started crying. He couldn't continue with all the crap that I was throwing at him. And he was just humiliated. And I felt bad about it, but not bad to say it was my fault. I just didn't go to any more games. But I still blame the coach for losing the game and this incredible bit of denial. And thinking that I was so goddamn know-it-all and all of that stuff. And I never felt that way without booze. This is the illusion. Because, see, I blame so many of my problems because I'm left-handed, see? But doesn't my mind, everything's in reverse, right? What do they call it? This is over here, and it should be back over there. And naturally, when was I born? In June. I'm a Gemini, double personality. Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Wacko, you know? Why me, God? Never have taken the responsibility for my actions. Justify everything that I did. And I can recall many times, you know, going nuts wherever I was, and I'd hear someone saying, oh, Jimmy's really a nice guy. Tomorrow he won't remember what was going on, and he really, he's not this kind of a person. However, I know that I went as far as I went to be able to lose that other personality, to become that other being for the sick excitement, for the bizarre. That's why today, when I look at that second step, when it says something about insanity, I mean, I raise two hands when it says, will the insane stand up? Because I was completely whacked out. I'm still whacked out, but the difference is I know it today. So as time is progressing, I had another DWI and another DWI. Now I'm up to about 10 or 11 altogether. And of course, now they're all guilties because their breathalyzers are involved. And I'm being sent to jail. And one thing I love it, when people in turn will speak from the podium and they'll share, and they'll say the not yet. They haven't had a DWI, they haven't lost their license, they haven't been to jail. And I feel as though I've helped them in some way, shape, or form, because they left the bar just after me, and I was already pulled over, and they went right by. So, you know, at least that's the way I want to feel. And I was sentenced to jail, you know, the hotel plan. Now, the hotel plan is not that they send you to the Ramada or the Camelback Inn. They send you to jail, but they permit you to serve from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m. Then you go to work and you come back in again. And I went down there, and they didn't have my records, so I wouldn't be admitted. 30 days I was given, 30 nights. And they said, we'd go back to the court, and in turn, they'll give you a new sentencing date and come back when you're supposed to come back. I said, bullshit. I said, I'm here now. If you don't want me, you're going to have to come after me. Needless to say, justice runs very slow, but 6 months later, ever have the feeling that you're being watched? Really, you don't know where, but I had gone out to my car in the carport, and I just had that eerie feeling, and I looked down, and there was a car down the end of the street that I did not recognize. And I said, shit. I had a sales meeting that morning. So I get down on my belly, and I went under by front of the car and went through the side gate and around back. I had no sooner entered the house from the back when there were two flashing red and blue lights on in my driveway. And two of my kids are sleeping. This is 6:30. And come out, Jim. We know you're in there. I said, shit, what can I do? I need time to think. They don't give you any time. In 20 seconds, there are four more cars. Now there are three in each, there's a circular driveway, three in each driveway with the lights on. The noise is such, so both kids came out. Jimmy was probably 21, 22. Patrick was about 15, 16, I think. And I said, he said, what's happening? I said, I don't know, there's a mistake. And the cop said, I have a, James T. Coveney, I have a warrant for your arrest. I said, shit, I got an 8 o'clock sales meeting. Anyway, so the oldest one says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to take a shower. They won't bother me in the shower. I got news for you. Inside of 15 more seconds, they're on the side. I have a chair there or whatever it was. And they're on top of that, taking the gasket out of the kitchen window. So I said, shit, they mean business. So I said, okay, I'm coming out. And they said, are you armed? I said, no. I said, this is the truth. And I said, no. In fact, when I was growing up, my father wouldn't let any guns in the house. So my two kids are there, and all of a sudden, I open the door, and three officers have got guns. And I'm saying, what have I done? and they charged me with not showing up when I was supposed to show. I said, how come you're after me? There's murder, rapists, robbers, assault. Why me? Well, you know, if you play Monopoly, you know, when you ever land on that little thing that says jail, you go directly to jail. If you pass go, you don't collect 200. Well, when they took me in the car, they went right by my office, and they didn't even slow down. I went right to jail. So I'm in jail, and the next morning I have to appear in court, and I'm saying, shit, I got to get out of here. I've already talked to my lawyer, but no bond. They wouldn't even post any bond because they said I owed them straight time. Anyway, the next morning I'm up at 4 o'clock going down to Phoenix, and there is a, this is in December, very cold at 4 o'clock in the morning. The police officer had a heater on the cab of the car, and they had these fur-lined jackets. I had thongs on, something that said MCSD, Maricopa County Sheriff's Department, and little thin pants. And I put on the back of this thing that is freezing, now waiting for two more prisoners. A 19-year-old male prostitute was put in, and about an 18-year-old, black, both of them black, female hooker they picked up the night before. And I'm saying, I don't believe it. What the hell am I doing? You know, couldn't understand the rationale at all because, you know, don't belong here. Well, needless to say, I had to do the jail time, and that didn't do it. Now, that was my 12th DWI. So in turn, I had to see a probation officer, and he said, I don't believe in AA, but I'm going to give you a chance. You have to go to 30 AA meetings in 30 days, but you don't have to go to one every day, but the most you can do in one day is four. I said, okay, you know, when you're in front of her, and this is a black probation officer, nice guy, I guess. When I'm sitting in front of him, I say, yes, sir. When as soon as I got his office, I said, screw you, and, you know, I'm on my way. So about 7 days later, I realized that I have to, because they're going to be on my case, go to an AA meeting. So I've got a book, and I went to this meeting, which today is my home group, and it's a favorite meeting. And I sat down, and I'm critiquing everyone as they come in. And I'm sitting at the back, and they go to the kitchen. They come out with an ashtray, and they come out with a cup of coffee. And this took place for about 4 or 5 minutes, and there's about 25 people that are doing this. I'm saying, Christ, there's no way I can be alcoholic. I don't drink coffee, and I don't smoke. just a Scotia denial. So I left at halftime, you know, after the speaker got through, and I went to the safari for fun and games. And a funny thing happened. 6 months later, I got another DWI, and that was my 13th. And I had to go to see the judge, and he asked me if I was on probation, and I said no. And by this time, they were in the process of going to the computer, and so he put me on probation. I get the same dude that I was supposed to go before that I never turned any meetings to. So I said, you know, I'll pull the scam, and I won't bother seeing him. Just see what happens. So I did that, and the records were apparently screwed up somewhere, so I never heard from the probation officer. So, you know, I pulled another con. However, I realized that, hey, let's face it, something is happening along the way that I am losing control. There's no more $8,000 card games. There's no more fun and games. It's a bitch. You know, it's raining on my parade. I used to, you know, Idiano's hit, make the goddamn world go away, you know? Crazy. So I said, okay, being a former altar boy and being almost excommunicated, because when I was 9 years old, I was serving benediction. That's when they purify the altar with this charcoal with this thing they put on top of it. And I had never done it before. 9-year-old kid now. And I pulled the chain. There's two chains. I pulled the wrong one, and the goddamn thing turned over. And the charcoal burnt holes in the blue wall-to-wall velvet carpeting. And Father Feeney says, you bumbling idiot, screw. And I said, but Father, it was an accident. You know, another one of those accidents. So, you know, God was a fearful God. He was going to zap me, so he did his thing, and I said, you know, be with the good people, but, you know, I don't deserve you. Well, now, as we progress back with the story, I realize that I have to do something because, man, it's a bitch. I'm existing. I'm in a war, and every day is a battle. You know, when I get up at 6, the world is up at 5. I'm up at 5, the goddamn world is up at 4:30. They're putting the screws to me, you know, day in and day out. So anyway, I started going to Bible study. And it was inspirational, motivating, enthusiastic, and I loved it. Thursday morning at 7 o'clock, I'd shoot down to this businessman's Bible study. A beautiful fella ran it. He was a former hard rock DJ in Phoenix. He was the hard rock DJ of the year in 69, 70, 71. And he saw the light, alcoholic, crazy guy. But he, in turn, has a beautiful ministry, and I felt good. And I learned God. I learned what God has done to many people's lives and how, in turn, he could play this part in my life. And in turn, I was going to be systematic as far as drinking. And I had a ministry. I had a right to go in the bars now because I was going to be a sender or a representative of Larry Wright and talk up this Abundant Life program. And that worked great for about two drinks. After the second drink, and when the pretty blonde came in, I said, what the hell's that? But I kept on going for this year. And I found all about, you know, how he loves us unconditionally and so forth. And as time is progressing, I had control of my drinking, and everything was in the process of coming around, you know, I thought. But we all know, as chapter 5 tells us, alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful, and ever so patient. So I was down visiting some friends around 5 o'clock at Walter's Continental, where you can buy a bucket of booze for a buck, you know. Wow. Happy hour, you get two buckets. Just what I needed. So I was drinking soda water and lime for about 3 hours and about four or five rounds, and someone said, let's all have a round of drinks, only give Jimmy some booze this time. And I said, vodka tonic. Well, to make a long story a little bit longer, about 10 o'clock, this is about 5 or 5:30, I can recall going to two or three different places, and as I'm going across town into Phoenix, I look in my rearview mirror, and that red and blue light is flashing again. And I said, son of a bitch. Now, of course, the first thing they do is to give you a curb breathalyzer test, you know, as far as functions, reflexes, and so forth. And I had been through it 13 times before, and I could give it as well as the cops. You know, they say stick a finger to your nose. Well, one won't do, so if I go five fingers, I may hit it with one. And I was doing, you know, the walking, trying to hold on to something while I'm walking. And I said, geez, you're making me stay up too long. And I'd fall down, all of this jazz. He says, we're going to take you in. Man, and I knew I was in deep shit because they were starting to prosecute DWIs and they were going to throw me in jail for 2 years. No BS in there. So I get down to the briefing station and you have a choice to take the breathalyzer or not. But if you don't, you lose your license for 6 months. If you do, and if you get away with it, man, you're clean. So I was trying to pull a scam and I'm saying, I need some time. So I go into this room and I need privacy. And now, I don't know whether any of you have been through traumatic situations when you've been bombed, but something that is so heavy, it sobers you up to the degree that you know what you want and you strive to get it and to do this, but you still, you know, have a ton of juice in you. So this is what was happening. I, in turn, realized that having been in Bible study for a year, that God, in his infinite wisdom, can be called upon. And after all, I have been a real good Twinkie for the last year, except for just one or two situations, you know? So I said, God, I need your attention, you know? You know how you'll have your dad and Myra talking, and your little kid is like 5 years old, and he's talking to the dad, and the dad's not paying any attention, so the little kid goes to dad and gets his face, you know. This is what I was doing to God. I need your attention. I said, we're in trouble. I said, now, I didn't mean to drink, you know, and if you help me out this time, oh, I'll be yours forever. And I said, I know that you raised Lazarus from the dead. You made the blind see, the lame walk, the deaf hear, you parted the Red Sea, you cured the lepers, and dear God, I need your help right now. I want to blow fresh air in the breathalyzer. Now, as I'm talking to, you know, to my God, I'm going, get out the bad air and inhale the good air. Now, there's a cop watching this circus, and he's saying, hey, Jim, are you going to take the test or aren't you? I said, wait a minute. I said, are we ready? So I got the signal we were ready, you know. I said, okay. So I went into the room and I sat down. I had been very familiar with this specific machine. And I'm still going, you know, and I figured, geez, I have to get rid of some of it by now, right? Well, I shut my eyes and I said, we'll just, you know, do it, that's all. And all of a sudden I blew for about 5 seconds. That's all you have to do. And that sucker started clicking. And that blew up to 2.5. Now, anyone knows 2.5 is not a marginal reading. Where I was, it's a 0.1 and you're dead. So I was 2.5 times dead. And I'm saying, to see what you've done, you know, that's it, that's it. And I said at that time, my life is over. I can remember saying it vividly because I knew I was going to go to jail for 2 years. Shit, that was it. I was held down the shit chute, period. So I called home from the police station and I asked for a ride home. And it was negatory, Big Ben. Get your own goddamn ride. So I paid $30 for a cab, and I didn't sleep at all that night. It was, you know, anxiety. And this is what happened for such a long period of time. I had fears, apprehensions, crazy mood swings because I wasn't controlling my life. So anyway, that following morning is when I had my own first spiritual awakening, and that was that there was help for me, and that was through a treatment center. And I called up a treatment center, went over to, pardon me, to St. Luke's Hospital, and I said, now, I don't want to have anyone calling me a drunk or an alcoholic. And they said, no, we won't do that. He said, you can make your own determination. So I said, okay, that sounds fair. They asked me what the problem was, and I said I had a screw loose up here that must have rusted. If they could fix that sucker, you know, I'll go back the way it used to be. So they said, come on in, I'd like to learn about the disease of alcoholism. Now, that was the very first time I'd heard about alcoholism being a disease. I, like Mary, thought that only the winos and the wackos and my uncle, you know, those were alcoholics. And I was functional, and I was responsible, and I was, you know, kidding myself, too, under the illusion that I was this and I was that. But so I sat down, and I started learning about it. I saw Father Martin's Chalk Talks and Dr. Pirsch regarding this disease. And when it came my turn to take my first step, God, it took about an hour. All that shit came out that was stored, and I was suffocating myself with for such a long period of time. And I'm now, you know how you do things, and they're bad, so you just, they put them in a memory bank, and you close the cover, and you never want to remember it again because of the humiliation, the embarrassment, the pain, and all of that shit. Here, the cover started coming off, and I'm looking at 14 DWIs that I blame the world for. And I realized that I was the only constant in all of those happenings. Different locations, different police, different circumstances, but JTC was at every single one of them. So it was me that put the juice in my mouth and went wacko. It wasn't anyone else saying, you know, drink this or I'll kill you. So it was easy to come up with that part there. And then I, the more aspect of, you know, the drunk and being irresponsible and how I needed help. How I needed help because the pain was just coming out. And I had no idea what to do, but this was a hope. And I heard about, after being an outpatient for 30 days, I in turn was told that you go to AA meeting, 90 meetings in 90 days. And the things that I recall so vividly were that phrases, like, you have to surrender unconditionally to be completely victorious. Now, this was kind of foreign talk to me because I always, in whatever I did, left a loophole to escape. I would always make sure that I took care of me because if the going got too tough, I screwed, you know, couldn't face the music. Here, they said, in order to be completely victorious, you have to surrender unconditionally, surrender to win, wave the white flag. And I had nowhere else to go. And I stayed there, and I came to meetings. And I, in turn, went to my first meeting at another club that has a rehab center. And you had to, any newcomers in the first 30 days, and I told myself as I sat in the back, I wasn't going to stand up. I was there, you know, to observe again and listen to it, but quietly walk in and quietly walk out. Well, as soon as they had mentioned, are there any newcomers in the first 30 days, my ass was off the chair and I was standing up. And I'm saying, shit, I didn't mean to stand up. And there's about eight people in front of me, and I'm saying, you know, the pride and the vanity and the crazy thought process, they're all going to look at me. They're all going to know that I'm an alcoholic. And when it came to me after five or six introduced themselves, I said, I'm Jimmy Coveney, and I couldn't get that word out. I'm an alcoholic. But it felt good. I get it out, and they clapped for me, newcomer. And I felt good about it, you know. I belonged. Before, I had never belonged anywhere. I was the type of a person that would put these square pegs in round holes and force these suckers in because I wanted it the way I wanted it. And that was the way I thought it should be. Today, almost 5 years later, I can honestly and truthfully say my higher power is so loving and forgiving and caring and compassionate that he and I are together 24 hours a day. I love him so much, and he's helped me so much because he has taught me how to get out of self. Self, Jimmy was his problem, of course. Just looking at self and realizing that how ill-equipped I was to face the music. As Mary had said, drinking is a symptom. I had no idea. Yeah, I heard the symptom, but what the hell else is there beside the symptom? Naturally, it's having the equipment to cope with life on life's terms. Don't run when things get heavy. Work through the situation. So today I do daily take the first, second, and third of I can't, he can, and gosh, I'm going to let him. And it's beautiful, and I love the 11th, and I love the 6th and 7th when I ask for some humility so I can work through. And I have become teachable because I've learned to work the program the way the program's supposed to be worked. Any newcomers, I just love the steps. Work the steps. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. I go to 14 or 16 meetings a week. I have a job in trucking where I can hit an early morning meeting, a nooner, and maybe a couple at night. So it's no big deal. I used to spend 30, 40 hours a week in bars spending $200 or $300, you know, on phony checks, on kiting and, you know, this crazy shit. How can you beat it? 14 meetings for $14. It's a hell of a deal. I know a good deal when I see one. I'm still compulsive. Now, today, what I've learned through both AA and Al-Anon is that I have to take care of Jimmy. No one else can. No one else can make me happy. Happiness has to come from within. And the way it is with me, if I am fulfilled in living my life the way my higher power wants me to, my feet just start jumping, my eyes start sparkling because I am on a natural high. I went back to several of my favorite haunts when I was in the program about a year and a half, and I saw dimly lit bars, lonesomeness, dirtiness, all negatives. You know, the mystique had gone. Not only the desire to drink had left me, but the association of even being in that area. It was just a miracle that God does provide. And I truly am one of those believers that believes that God speaks to each and every one of us. So when I go to my meetings, I want to stay and hear everyone and share what's inside me and listen to what's inside them. And I come out stronger. I feel very much fulfilled. I have the three sons, and they do their thing. Fortunately, to this point in time, none of them have crossed the imaginary line. But if they do, they realize it's a program, and I don't have to be on their case saying, you know, how much of your drink or where you're going. I realize today it's a full-time job taking care of Jimmy. I am still crazy, no question about it, but I like it because God made only one of me. That's all the world could handle. But the difference being today, when I do have these thought processes, he removes this desire before it goes into action. So today, I can truly say, instead of living in that abstract world of wild colors and crazy bizarre happenings, I choose to live in a vanilla world. And it's not Haagen-Dazs or Dries, it's just plain old vanilla. And it's fun showing up for life on a day-to-day basis because I have no idea who God is going to put in my life or who God is going to send me to. And so I kind of call it like a joyous adventure. You know, the program to me is the yellow brick road of life. And I know when I'm on it and I know when I'm off it. And when the old thought process come back and I start thinking wacko thoughts, you know, I just ask my higher power to remove these thoughts. And he does. So it's really I can't say enough about it. It truly is joyous. I've become joyous, happy, and free. And like the promises tell us, the second promise, you know, we will not regret the past and I wish to shut the door on it. I knew I had to live every goddamn yesterday, every drink, every jail cell, every DWI, every bit of pain and craziness to be where I am today. And I carry that pink ticket of my last DWI, and when I have this kind of euphoric recall and saying, yeah, but wasn't it fun, I just take out that ticket and look at that sucker and realize how much pain and agony and craziness went with that way of life. Again, I want to thank you so much for inviting me up here, because it's just fantastic. And meeting new friends, you know, each of you is a new friend of mine that I just hadn't met yet until this evening. And the program is the program, Universal International. And the love that we have for each other, we just can't compare it with anything else. Thank you very much.